listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, Taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I am your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me for a second time, I believe it's the second time, that Charles Hugh Smith is with me. Charles Hugh Smith is the author, proprietor of the popular blog OfTwoMinds.com, OfTwoMinds.com. He started that in 2005, and he is also a contributor to PeakProsperity.com. He is the author of numerous books, including Why Everything is Falling Apart, An Unconventional Guide to Investing in Troubled Times, and another book that he's written more recently, Money and Work Unchained. He is in that book has addressed the idea of UBI, that's Universal Basic Income. So lots of really interesting content. I read Charles's stuff from time to time. It appears on Zero Hedge. His reach is very far. I just had a nice compliment from Jeff Deist, who was delighted to hear that Charles was coming on. He's, Jeff reads Charles's work on a regular basis and loves it. So, Charles, thanks for joining me again today.
It's my pleasure, Jay. You cover the really important topics, so I'm always delighted to be on your program.
Yeah, we certainly the topics that are of interest to me. I'm accused sometimes of being too selfish. I get people on I like to talk to and people I'm interested in what they have to say, but I think that's what a host should do. You don't want to bring people on that you're disinterested in. So anyway, I found your article obviously very timely. There is no free trade. There is only the Darwinian game of trade. Now, in theory, free international trade is good. It makes lots of sense because countries do what they have a comparative advantage in doing. They exchange those products for something to another country that's not good at producing those. So in theory, 1 + 1 equals more than 2. It equals 3 or 4 or whatever. But in reality, your article points out that that isn't the way the world really works. You point out that the world is really a dog-eat-dog sort of a place, so that international trade boils down to 4 Darwinian goals that has more to do with what might makes right than fairness, I would say. Could you tell our listeners what those 4 Darwinian goals are?
Sure. I think that by Darwinian, of course, we mean survival of the fittest, right?
Sure.
And so the context here of these 4 points is that when you're trying to gain an advantage in a trade, then you will, of course, say it's a free trade. Mm-hmm. When you're at a disadvantage, then you'll call it unfair trade.
Uh-huh.
And so that's where the political boundaries are. It all depends on which perspective you have. If you are benefiting from that trade, then you call it free trade. And if you're not benefiting and you're at a disadvantage, then you call it unfair trade. So
okay. Charles, if I may, so if we look at who is pushing free trade most, you can be pretty sure those are the countries that are benefiting most from so-called free trade.
Exactly. And so if we look back over history, as you say, in general, trade is very beneficial for the reasons you described, comparative advantage, mm-hmm. and it allows every enterprise to have a broader market, right? Because now you can sell, you know, overseas. So, but stripped of the sort of abstractions, what I think trade boils down to is, number one, find foreign markets to absorb your excess production. Mm-hmm. So if you're making too many TVs, you got to find someplace to dump them.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, extract foreign resources at low prices. So foreign trade in this case is you go buy a copper mine someplace in a third world country where mm-hmm. the production costs are cheap, and then you can guarantee a nice low cost supply of copper. Number three is deny geopolitical rivals access to these resources. So if you can control, say, oil in a particular area, then you can deny that oil to your geopolitical rivals. Mm-hmm. And number four, you want to open other people's markets to your capital. In other words, so that your citizens and corporations can go buy the resources in other countries.
Yeah, and in fact, you also recently wrote an article, I think, to do with that whole issue of getting, the capital aspect, that last of the four. Could you talk to us a little bit more about that? Perhaps, I can't remember the name of the article that you wrote, but there was an article that you actually talked about the capital, about capital fitting into the trade, issue.
Right. And so, Jay, the context here is the major nations and trading blocs like the European Union, the U.S., Japan, and China, they have central banks that create basically free money, as you've discussed with many of your guests. So corporations in these nations can borrow money at almost nothing, and then they can go into developing world countries, and they can outbid the local people for the key profitable resources. And so it's really unfair because they're not all – the cost of capital and the access to capital is completely skewed in favor of those nations with central banks creating money for nothing.
Yeah. Well, the central banks, I would think the ones in particular that are aligned with the what I call the Anglo-American Empire, the United States, which owns the world's reserve currency, at least at the moment it does. It's not as if, I mean, Venezuela has a central bank as well, but nobody's accepting Venezuelan currency these days, I think, right? So it must be that that America and countries closely aligned with America, the European countries that have strong central banks, it's not just any central bank. So what you're saying is it would be mostly those countries that are aligned to the empire, perhaps, that benefit most?
Well, certainly those that have the largest economies and therefore the world accepts their currencies, at least as you said, at this point.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking at a map that I just came across this morning of average weighted tariff rates applied across all products. And I think this was the World Bank or the IMF or somebody. I can't remember the sources. World Bank. And the countries with the lowest tariffs, we're looking at actually Canada is a little bit lower, according to this, a little bit lower than the U.S. The U.S., Australia, and Western Europe, and these are countries that are most closely aligned, I would argue, with the United States. And you go to countries like the ones that agricultural countries or raw material countries like Brazil, Argentina, several African countries have the highest tariffs. I think maybe it's Bangladesh. India is pretty high. Their tariffs are pretty high. China and Russia, not as high as India, but also have pretty high tariffs. I think in your article you talked a little bit about countries that produce raw materials. In fact, one of the few ways that they may be able to protect themselves from being devoured by some of the more powerful countries is by slapping on tariffs. Do you think that's maybe accounts for why some of those countries have higher tariffs?
Yes, Jay, I think that's true. And if we could look back at the history of the United States, when it was a developing country in the 18th century, the U.S. also had high tariffs to protect domestic industries from competitors who could just beat the pants off of domestic producers. But this is where we have to realize there's more to value, in our economy than simply the dollars and cents or the profits to be earned from exporting or importing. In other words, there's a national security interest really in having a domestic production economy, and so if we just look at exports and imports and profits, we might think, oh, we're doing great because, we're importing a lot of stuff at very low prices. But if we've lost our production base, we've actually weakened our nation, never mind how much profit got earned.
Would you argue that that's what's happened in the United States? We certainly have lost the production of things that people, the high tech, of course, is what we excel in to a great extent. But thinking of the manufacturing base, is there some claim to Trump's argument that if we lose our steel manufacturing, we don't have a country?
You know, you can argue with that, but in my view, you do want to support production of essentials in, mm-hmm. In your own nation, and that because you can't really, if you look at history, you can't really count on imports flowing in at low prices forever. Things mm-hmm. happen, mm-hmm. and so you're creating a very fragile economy if you're dependent on other nations for your essentials, and you can't really put a price tag on that. So mm-hmm. whether it's steel or soybeans or wheat or aircraft carriers or aircraft, I mean, there's a computer chips. There's a lot of things that are considered national security interests, and so I think we do need to look at the value above and beyond the profit margin.
You know, you commonly, as you point out in your article, one of the big arguments for so-called free trade is that consumers benefit so much from that. I mean, that's always the push. Of course, there's a lot of consumer votes out there. But you point out that it isn't the consumers that are not really doing all that well. There's some other interests that do a lot better. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, Jay, I find this really interesting because when people say that you know, free trade really lowers our prices, they don't really put any numbers behind it. And so there was some people have attempted to put numbers there. And what they've come up with is the consumers have saved, say, between $100 billion and $200 billion over the last decade in lower prices by us having an economy dependent on imports. But American corporations, which offshored all of their production in order to, you know, increase their profits, their profits have gone up from $400 billion a year before the emergence of China as a trading powerhouse to $2.3 trillion, almost $2 trillion more a year in profits, much of which has been earned from offshoring production to Asia. And so it seems to me the corporations have benefited. The consumers has gotten crumbs.
Mm-hmm.
And the quality – oh, pardon me.
No, go ahead.
Oh, and the quality of the goods that are being imported has declined dramatically.
Yeah. It's so – and this is what Trump called the hollowing out of – or other people have talked about the hollowing out of the middle class, the industrial base of the United States.
That's right. And I also wanted to mention, Jay, that, you know, other nations play a lot of tricks. And so when you mm-hmm. talk about free trade or fair trade, they don't use tariffs. And Japan is a past master of this. And I'm not an expert on Japanese trade policy, but I am pretty familiar with the way they do their conduct their business. And like many of the other Asian countries, they completely protect their domestic industries, but they don't use tariffs. They use a bureaucratic thicket, more like a mm-hmm. moat. And so mm-hmm. What they'll do is, like, say, if you want to import, if the United States wants to export its electric guitars, is one of my examples, into Japan, well, the price is double what it is on the free market. So, well, how is that? There's no tariffs on electric guitars. Mm-hmm. Oh, but there's bureaucratic things. Well, we're not sure if your products are safe. So we need 5 years through our bureaucracy to make sure that your products are safe. I mean, these countries have so many ways to limit our imports from the U.S. And so it's just it really is unfair.
So there's a lot of other ways besides tariffs. You're saying that's not really the biggest issue. Is not the way that so it has to do with capital flows. I want to get back to this issue of capital flows and the United States owning the world's reserve currency. Do you think is that an important issue in this whole game of trade?
Oh, absolutely, Jay. And it's one of the issues that people don't seem to talk about, which always surprises me, is how has China made sure its currency, the yuan or the renminbi, is stable? Well, it's locked it to the U.S. dollar, right? If the U.S. dollar is stable, then China's currency is stable, and that's beneficial to them. that's a trade advantage to China, because let's say if their currency was went way down or went way up, that would really seriously impact their exports in terms of the value and so on. So, you know, that's one thing that people should focus on, is the U.S. dollar being the reserve currency. It's what the Chinese and other countries peg to, and as a way of making sure that they have access to our markets.
You, I want to get your ideas on this, the Shanghai or the petro yuan, which is something that that is being talked about in some circles, not too much in the mainstream press, but certainly some of the things that I read, and I suppose you read as well. That China has imported, and they produce, I think they're the number one gold producer in the world as well. They've built up their gold reserves, their official reserves, not actually Russia is supposed to have slightly more gold reserves now than China. But the One Belt, One Road project, China is now starting to do a lot of things in to access cheap raw materials in Eastern Africa. And you know, to just to set up the infrastructure for trading, the Shanghai Petroleum Futures Exchange, as well as the Shanghai Gold Exchange now, in theory at least, or not more than in theory. It's yesterday, I believe, was the first day, the 26th of March, when China was going to start officially buying oil for yuan, and the sellers of oil that might not want to hold yuan can hedge them on the gold exchange and the Shanghai Gold Exchange. With just a couple of minutes left here, do you have any ideas or any thoughts about that development and whether or not that may be a threat to the U.S. dollar hegemony? And if it is, if that might have something major to say about the direction of trade in the future?
Well, Jay, that's a great topic, and it's fairly complicated. But let's just take the beginning part, which is China has now become the largest importer of oil. It now imports more oil than the U.S., and of course, that's because the U.S. industry, due to fracking, has started to pump a lot more oil, and so we don't need to import so much. So China has a huge interest in securing its 10 million barrels a day or whatever it's importing, and so it's a natural development from their point of view to trade for their most essential import, oil, in their own currency. And of course, if we were in their shoes, we'd do the exact same thing. So yeah. I tend to think that I wish that China would decouple, you know, its currency from the U.S. dollar, and then it mm-hmm. would be it would trade as a free floating currency, and we'd actually get to know what its true value is. So
yeah.
I think we have to be a little cautious about the decline of the dollar, because other people have their national interest is to not be dependent on the dollar, and sure. we really can't begrudge them that. We sure. have to compete.
No, absolutely. Well, I think that's a good place to leave it, Charles. We are out of time here. My engineer tells me we have less than a minute. I want to tell our listeners it's of2minds.com, of2minds.com. I guess, Charles, that's where people should go to follow what you're doing. And also, you you know, you don't charge people, but you do accept you know, gifts from people. I think my wife has sent you a little bit of money, and because we really enjoy your work. Jeff Dice said he does. And I would just tell people to go to of2minds.com. Check out Charles's work. The just some very insightful articles. How often do you publish, Charles?
Three times a week.
Three times a week. There you go. Well, I know I see it constantly. Zero Hedge picks up your material, and I should be going to Of Two Minds more often myself, probably to gain some more wisdom for this show. Thank you so much for being with us, Charles. It's great to have you, and I hope we can have you back again sometime in the near future.
Thank you, Jay. It's been my pleasure.
All right, folks. Well, that is all the time for this week. Next week, we'll be back. Alistair McLeod is going to be with us. Also, Brian Groves of Genesis Metals. And with a little luck, we'll also have Michael Oliver with us again. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Bye. Montera Resources, an advanced exploration company, is aggressively expanding its high-grade Gladiator gold deposit in Quebec, Canada. Over the last 12 months, Bonterra has raised over $60 million and has attracted strategic investors Eric Sprott, Kirkland Lake Gold, and New York-based Vanek Gold Fund. Bonterra is focused on updating its 43-101 resource in the second half of 2018 and will incorporate up to an additional 100,000 meters of drilling, where the dimensions of the Gladiator deposit have been expanded to date nearly 500%. Bonterra trades in Canada under the symbol BTR and in the U.S. under the symbol BONXF.
Auren Resources is a technically driven, capital-efficient exploration company focused on delivering shareholder value through accretive project acquisition and discovery. The company's management team has a record of success in the discovery, advancement, and monetization of exploration assets. Auren's focus is on advancing its seven premier gold exploration projects located in Canada and Peru. Auren's shares trade on the TSX in Canada and the NYSE American in the U.S. under the stock symbol AUG. For more information, please visit AurenResources.com.